The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Students of the Game. My name is Alex Bauman, and as always, I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Gray Oldenburg and Nathan Gladwell. Today's going to be entirely AAA, and let's hop right into it, guys, with the first story. The Johnny Manziel documentary released this past week. It's titled Untold Johnny Football. That's on Netflix. Some things we learned, pretty interesting, is a fourth-string college teammate took drug tests for him while he was at Texas A&M. His dad almost faked a heart attack to get him out of drug test at the NFL Combine. And he admitted to watching 0 total seconds of film during his time in Cleveland. There's also a little tidbit where his best friend in high school said he didn't even find him watching film for high school either. So, but what do you make of Johnny Manziel for all this in the documentary released this past week, guys?
That's crazy. Look, first of all, let me say it's a really, really good documentary. If you haven't watched it and you enjoy, you know, getting the behind the scenes, that sort of stuff, and love football and that sort of stuff, and we're around during this situation with Johnny Football, his career, let's just say, you'll find this very interesting. And because of what's happening with NIL and what the NCAA has moved towards now with everything that's going on now, it's kind of interesting to see what was going on back in 2012 and 2013 with a guy of this kind of publicity and success that he was having at Texas A&M, and what was going on behind the scenes. It was crazy to watch and think about. I'll just start off. I mean, I think all of us kind of knew. I think a lot of people kind of knew that there were some themes going on behind the scenes especially at Texas A&M when Johnny Manziel was there and having the success that he had, because we all knew that he seemed like the type of guy, even when he was on the football field, that just ate all that success up and used it as fame instead of fuel, and really it just drove him into the party scene. And you know, obviously we saw that kind of take over his NFL career. And Alex, you said the documentary mentioned he watched 0 seconds of film during his time when he was drafted in the first round by the Cleveland Browns. No wonder he was so bad. He was terrible for the Browns. I just thought it was really crazy, but I really enjoyed the documentary and seeing what all kinds of crap Johnny Manziel and his agent and they were having to do and deal with him throughout his whole career.
With Johnny Manziel's personality, I kind of always figured that he had this second side to him. Of course, we didn't see it a whole lot. Media basically focused on his college football career pretty heavily and then getting into the NFL. But once he reached the NFL, it just became wild. He was all over the place. I know he was going through a lot, but still thinking about the college, it doesn't surprise me that he went through all of that, had all that happen to him. To watch 0 seconds of film, I feel like you have to actually be trying to not watch film in order to do that. Especially like these people were playing football. You got to like football to play it. So you got to like watching it too. So how do you not watch any film at all? That's crazy to me. That's probably the craziest thing out of all of this to me. And that's with all the drugs and other stuff he did.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised with all this, but for me, if he didn't watch any film in Cleveland, let's say he watched minimal film at Texas A&M outside of the required stuff he had to do when he was at the facility. I mean, he won the Heisman at Texas A&M. He had all the talent in the world. We saw it on the football field. We saw it in the Alabama game that I hate to rewatch and relive over and over again.
You had to bring that up, Alex.
I mean, this dude was uber talented. And it just tells me that if he took this game seriously and sat down and watched the film and all that, he could have been a successful NFL quarterback. I wouldn't say it to the level of somebody like Patrick Mahomes, but he could have been kind of like a Josh Allen, something like that, if he would have taken this game seriously and not had all the off the field stuff. But it's sad to see a guy with all that talent kind of throw it away and waste it, because he had the world in his hand and he just threw it away. But I wish him all the best in what he does in his future endeavors, because apparently he's going to be starting a bar down in College Station. And I forget what it's going to be called. I want to say it's like Johnny Football or something. So hopefully that takes off for him and he's able to enjoy that more than he did playing in the NFL. All right, move on to the next story. This is another weird one. a retired NFL star is subject of the 2009 movie The Blind Side, Michael Orr, petitioned a Tennessee court with allegations that a central element of the story was a lie concocted by the family to enrich themselves at his expense. The petition alleges that the Tuohys never adopted Orr, but instead tricked him into signing a document that made them his conservators, which gave them the legal authority to make business deals in his name. It also alleges the Tuohys used that power to strike the deal that paid them and their two birth children millions of dollars in royalties from the Oscar-winning film that earned more than $300 million. But Orr apparently got nothing. Guys, a couple weeks ago, we kind of did that episode where we were talking about our favorite movies, our favorite sports movies. And y'all both mentioned The Blind Side, and I said, there's stuff coming about this, guys. This wasn't really real at all. It wasn't a quote-unquote documentary. It was more of, and I know majority of documentaries like The Blind Side, there's stuff that they add and take away and, you know, make it where it's enjoyable to watch on film. But this, it was like this whole film was basically a lie. So what do y'all think about this, all this coming out about The Blind Side and the Tuohys and all what they've done to Michael Orr?
This is so weird. Just like you mentioned, Alex, there'll always be with sports stories like this that are movie worthy. They'll always, you always hear the term, they get Hollywood and they add stuff and take stuff out and, you know, remove important details to the story and add details that just like you said, Alex, makes it enjoyable for the, you know, who's ever watching the film. But this is a different level. My concern with this isn't about that they never adopted him or that they used most of the story as a lie or made up most of the story. It's the fact that they tricked him, the Tuohys tricked him into basically becoming Michael Orr.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally. And made millions and millions of dollars in royalties off this video, off this award-winning film. And Michael Orr got nothing. And I know the story is about how the Tuohys took in Michael Orr. Apparently, that's a lie. But also, the story is about Michael Orr and his success story from where he went to him getting to the NFL and getting to college and that sort of thing. And he got nothing. I mean, this is going to be a thing for a very, very long time here in the foreseeable future. And I hope this does get resolved in Michael Orr's favor moving forward.
I mean, this just makes me sick. This makes me not want to watch The Blind Side ever again. It feels like everything that I watched is a lie. This whole situation is just crushing to see, especially for Michael Orr and him having to have this life experience that he was just taken advantage of. And it's extremely awful that it's gotten to this point. And it has just ruined one of my all-time favorite movies. It is sickening.
Yeah, I mean, the movie made it seem like the Tuohys kind of made Michael Orr into this all-pro, all-American type talent, but the real story is that he was that before he met them. He was in 11th grade. He was like one of the best offensive linemen in the nation. And the only problem was he didn't really have anywhere to live because, like in the movie, that's one of the key things that kind of kept true to is his mother was a drug addict and all that type of stuff. So he's placed in foster care and all that and bounced around. But it made it seem like the Tuohys kind of made Michael Orr and he was kind of this stupid homeless kid that they picked up off the street. In reality, apparently, Michael Orr was very intelligent and very talented before they took him in. And the fact that they took this movie and made it sort of something that made them look good instead of something where it felt like they didn't really tell Michael's real story, which it should have been all about in the first place, considering it's titled The Blind Side, the story of Michael Orr. It's just sickening. And I know those people are going to be saying that, why did he wait so long? And why is this coming out now? Well, Orr didn't retire until 2016, and he really didn't. And when the film came out, he was just starting his career in 2009. So he really didn't have the time to investigate all this stuff. But when he retired in 2016, he hired a lawyer and that helped him kind of uncover all the stuff that came out about it. And the fact he didn't make any money off of it. And the fact that he really wasn't their adopted kid. So the Tuohys, if this comes out to be true, which I expect it probably is, I mean, that's awful. This kid came into your house. You fed him. You helped him out. You basically coerced him apparently into going to Ole Miss, which I think was, probably one of the main reasons they wanted him is because they wanted him to go to Ole Miss and play there. But this family, that's awful look for them. And we just went over two documentaries, somewhat documentaries. Obviously, Johnny Football is a little bit different than The Blind Side because The Blind Side is more of a Hollywood movie. But with these documentaries, I mean, since The Last Dance, it feels like there's just a oversaturation of them now, guys. Is that something we need to be worried about in the future?
Yeah, the film industry is always going to be a weird one to me. It's one that I don't personally understand. And it's one that if you don't understand, you're going to get taken advantage of. And I think that's part of the issue that came up with Michael Orr. Cause just like you said there, Alex, this movie came out in 2009. He was just starting his career in the NFL. Once he retired, he hired that lawyer. And now he's just now starting to uncover these things because they were so well kept in secret. I'm sure the Tuohys were lawyered up as well. So I think it could become an issue where you just see some of these documentaries and even movies based on real stories or supposed to be based on real stories, just not, the sports movies aren't the same anymore. You know,
they're really not.
It's hard to watch sometimes.
Yeah, it seems like they're just going after the cash. I mean, that's what all of this is. Back to thinking about, I rewatched Raider last night, and that's probably one of the greatest sports films of all time. And now you really think, could one of your other films be altered in a way that it's lying to you and makes me rethink of all these films that I've already watched or some of these films that are coming out? Do I really want to watch them? Because are they true or not?
Yeah, I mean, Hollywood as a whole, kind of like you mentioned, Gray, that whole film industry is a really hard thing to grasp. And with all the strikes going on and the actors and writers wanting more stuff and all that, I mean, it feels like that industry is really kind of grimy and weird to be in. I don't know. It worries me because the movies coming out nowadays aren't what they used to be, like you mentioned, Gray, whether that's sports movies or movies in general. Because talking about Marvel, I mean, those movies are not what they used to be. I just hope we can get back to the times where we had movies like Grader coming out and Coach Carter. I mean, that's still a good one I go back to. Even though The Blind Side's not real, I mean, the acting in that movie was very well done, whether, I mean, that was all a lie or not. I mean, Sandra Bullock won an Oscar for that movie. So I hope we can get back to the days where movies are good and enjoyable to watch, and it's just not thrown out there for a money grab or a cash grab by these giants in the film industry. All right, moving on to the next story. Pac-12 school, Stanford in California, fell one vote short of the 12 required to join the ACC at the start of the 2024 season. The four schools that opposed were Florida State, Clemson, North Carolina, and crazily, NC State did as well. SMU, another school rumored to be lobbying to be in the ACC, did not even have a vote held on their admission. Guys, what do you make of this in the ACC basically saying, we don't want these additions into our conference, where you got conferences like the Big Ten and the Big 12, any every school they can in their conference?
Yeah. First of all, let me address this. If let's say this vote went the other way and the one vote went towards the addition of Stanford and California in the ACC. Did you hear that? Stanford and California in the Atlantic Coastal Conference. I know the geography has completely gone out the window, but what the heck? What the heck? That would be such a problem. I think the ACC is, well, I think especially the four schools that said no to this, Florida State, Clemson, North Carolina, NC State, I think they see them in the future, whether that be very, very soon or a few years in the future, not being in the ACC anymore. Because I could easily see all four of those teams coming to the SEC, or two going to the SEC and two going to the Big Ten or something like that. But I think it's interesting that they don't want any part of it because, you know, we talked about this a month before the Pac-12 basically imploded itself. We all three predicted it here on this show. And I think we go ahead and make that prediction for the ACC. I don't know if it's going to be as quickly as the Pac-12 was, because the Pac-12, it seemed like it was instant and they were all gone except for the four left. But I think the ACC is headed towards that direction too. And we could see a Power 3 conference very, very soon.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, Gray. I don't know the matter of time in which the ACC is going to dissolve, but I just know that it's on its last legs. And obviously with this vote, not adding schools to a conference that is on life support, basically, that basically tells you that the schools that are already in it see that it's dying. They want to get out as fast as possible. And of course, the schools that are denying the vote are the schools that are the highest grossing, make the most money for the conference. So obviously the ACC, they're gonna split off. You can flip a coin who goes where, but they're going to go where the money is. And it's all going to come down to the money. It's sad to see the ACC go to this, but let's be honest, it hasn't been competitive. It's not fun to watch anymore. It's very similar to the Pac-12, where I guess you can call it the Pac-4 now, because that was just stripped of everything. So yeah, I think we're going to head towards a Power 3, whether that be SEC, Big 10, and Big 12. I don't really know if you can call the Big 12 power at this point in time. I don't think it's power at this point in time because of the schools they added, but it could be eventually.
Yeah, I think the one thing that kept the ACC from imploding, kind of like the Pac-12 did, is their grant of rights, the massive TV deal they signed with ESPN a couple years ago. That's really been difficult for these teams like Clemson, Florida State, North Carolina, NC State to get out of the ACC, because they'd have to like pay a huge sum of money, and then the conference would still hold their TV rights for X amount of years and stuff like that. Well, the Pac-12, I think after this season, they don't have technically a TV deal or a grant of rights. They kept those schools in there, which made it easier for teams like Oregon and Colorado and all those type of teams to easily exit and go to the other conferences they wanted to go to. So I think the ACC, the conference has that grant of rights. It's kind of preventing these teams from leaving. But if they figure out a way to get out of it, the ACC will fall much quicker than somebody like the Pac-12 did, where you might see every team leave within a day or two.
Yeah. I think with the ACC, just like you mentioned, Alex, that TV deal with ESPN, has kept them together so far, because you mentioned the Pac-12. After this season, their TV deal is done. They tried to renegotiate with ESPN. ESPN was like, all right, we'll give you $30 million per school. And the Pac-12 said, no, we want 50. And ESPN told them goodbye. And then they imploded on themselves. So, but the ACC, that is kind of the glue keeping them together, because, I mean, we talked about these four schools. Nathan, you mentioned that these four schools are the highest grossing for that conference. And that is the reason that they don't want somebody else like that coming in. And, you know, we were talking about this when we talk about the film industry with Blindside. It's all about the money. And that's all we're seeing with this conference. We're not looking about, we're not looking at geography, obviously. I mentioned that just a second ago, but we're obviously not looking at the health and well-being of the student athletes or the coaches or anything like that. We're just looking at the money, and that's all that matters, apparently.
Apparently, that's all that matters nowadays. It's just money, 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 money. Don't really care about the people in it, which is very sad.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to something that's pretty sad in itself as well. North Carolina receiver Devontae or Tez Walker had his waiver for immediate eligibility denied by the NCAA. This comes due to the NCAA's new two-time transfer guidelines that indicate that they will not approve a student athlete trying to transfer a second time due to a coaching change, a lack of playing time, a new role on the team, or having the scholarship pulled. In a statement made by Walker, he said he chose to transfer from Kent State to UNC to be closer to his ailing grandmother. Guys, I know the NCAA has these guidelines set to prevent certain things from happening that, you know, people just want to leave a school because they're not getting playing time or something like that, or don't care to fight for it. But to deny Tez Walker's waiver, it baffles me, and it bothers me, because the NCAA, we've gone over multiple times, I don't know what's going on with that. They just feel like they're just fighting, trying to get their power back. And this is one of the times they're just trying to put it out there to other athletes, like, hey, we have the power.
I'm a loss for words for this one, because I love that these guidelines exist for the NCAA, because I think it's good to have those, because you don't want to see the second time transfer because of a coaching change or lack of playing time or rules or something like that. You don't want to see people bounce around like we see a lot nowadays. But that is the reason why waivers and appeals are invented, because of situations like Tez Walker's. because he is going from Kent State to North Carolina, not because Drake May is the quarterback, even though that's a great reason, but because he's trying to be closer to his grandmother. It's the reason these waivers exist and they denied him again. That's ridiculous. I'm lost for words.
Yeah, all of this is just sick, man. The NCAA is power hungry, and for him to have his waiver denied because he wants to be closer to his grandmother, I mean, the NCAA is just sick for doing this. They should overturn this ruling. Just looking at his whole career, he hasn't gotten much playing time. Even at the university, like NC Central, he didn't even get to play because of COVID, because their season were canceled. So I think they should look into that. The only real team he's played for is Kent State, and that would mean he was only a one-time active transfer. So I think this should be overturned. I think this is absolutely sickening that they did this to him. And obviously, he's been put through a lot of stress and anxiety because of the situation, and it's only gotten worse for him.
Yeah, I hope the NCAA fixes this. Like you mentioned, Gray, I like the stuff about the transfer guidelines, two-time transfer guidelines being put in, but there's got to be circumstances kind of like Tez Walker's where you have to look at it and go, yeah, let's just approve this. I'm not sure. There's some other guys in the portal that transferred multiple times. The first one that comes to mind for me is Eric Gilbert, who I feel has been to about every SEC school he can be, and I think now he's at Nebraska. And I haven't heard anything about him getting his transfer denied. So I don't know what this is, if the NCAA is trying to make an example of Tez Walker, but they definitely chose the wrong guy to make an example of, because he's got the governor on his side, who's a UNC alum, the North Carolina governor for that matter. So they definitely picked the wrong guy to do this for, because Tez Walker deserves to be at UNC and to be closer to his grandmother. All right, let's move on to the next story. It's another story where the NCAA looks like a bunch of clowns. They negotiated a resolution between Michigan football head coach and the NCAA over alleged recruiting violations. We covered that story, I believe, a couple weeks ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. The suspension was a 4-game suspension to start this season, but it was not approved by the NCAA committee on infractions. The case will now move to further through the NCAA disciplinary system and probably won't be resolved till the 2024 offseason. What are your thoughts on this whole situation with Jim Harbaugh and the NCAA committee not really approving the suspension?
I don't even know what to think of this, because I know Jim Harbaugh really doesn't have any say in this, because they denied his suspension. I don't know what he could do, but I think the suspension this year would have worked just fine. My question is just, it's going to become more about what are we doing, NCAA? Like, what is the NCAA disciplinary system? Like, what do they do on a day-to-day basis? You're telling me y'all couldn't resolve this or approve the suspension? What was wrong with it? These were, just level one violations that was given a 4-game suspension that was approved by Harbaugh, and it fell through. I don't understand. I really don't even know what to think about this. It just doesn't seem like the NCAA knows what they're doing about anything nowadays, but this is just like, guys.
When we first went over the situation and Jim Harbaugh was looking at a 3-4-game suspension, I thought it was pretty fair. I thought, level one recruiting violations, he misses 4 games and then he's back with the team. I thought that was a fair punishment and stated by the university. But here comes the NCAA saying, well, this isn't good enough. We're going to postpone this ruling on it, and it's going to take us to the 2024 offseason. That is incredible. There is so much time in between that. It is baffling that they can't figure out a punishment for Jim Harbaugh in this point in time. Honestly, to this point, I think he should just not have a punishment at all, the way the NCAA has acted about this situation.
I think NCAA is just kind of bothered by the fact Harbaugh lied to him, and they're just trying to, like Tez Walker, kind of make an example out of him. I'm not sure why. I guess they just have something out for Jim Harbaugh. But I think it'd be very funny if after this season at Michigan, Harbaugh leaves and goes back to the NFL, like he's been rumored to, like the past 3 years. and just gives him the finger going out the door. I think that'd be kind of hilarious, because then at that point they really can't do anything to him. And if they would have just done this now, they could have had done something to him. So I think that'd be hilarious. But to delay this even further than what they already have, it's just going to be a distraction to Harbaugh and to the players and the university being like, okay, when is Harbaugh going to get suspended? What's the punishment? And they just sit there and they sit there and they wait and they hope and they pray that nothing really happens. I don't know what the NCAA is doing. Just suspend him for the 4 games, move on and do something else with your life. I mean, there's so much different things going on with this country and the NCAA right now. They're going to be doing other than dealing with Jim Harbaugh and the minor thing he did by lying to you. Like, get over yourself. All right, moving on to the next story. The Philadelphia 76ers have ended trade talks involving guard James Harden and plan to bring him back to training camp for the start of the season. However, Harden has no plans to play for the Sixers this season and does not plan to report for training camp. And then earlier today, he went in front of a media and said something along the lines of, "Daryl Morey is a liar, and I will never be a part of an organization that he's a part of." Guys, what do you make of James Harden, the Sixers, and Daryl Morey and all that's going on?
I have no idea. Did he request a trade right when the offseason started? I believe it was a few months
around ago. The same time as Lillard.
Yeah, around the same time as Damian Lillard. And that's another one. Well, why hasn't he been traded yet? Now 76ers, you're just going to be paying a guy, what, $40, $45 million to not come to work every day. I'm really just, it's all about the money. We've been saying this over and over again. It's all about the money, especially with these front office guys, but even with these players, it's all about the money. And with the NBA players, it's turning into more about situations. You know, the last 10 years or so, we've seen more super teams than we have the last 30 years before then. And so it's becoming more about situations for players. And yes, it's about the money too. And the money, look, we saw with the Jaylen Brown contract, they're going to get money. They shouldn't be worried about money. But it seems like these franchises and these front office guys, like a guy like Morey, this is becoming ridiculous. I don't understand NBA. I don't understand the NBA anymore, because it used to be so simple. If you requested a trade early that summer before free agency started or around there, it seemed like that team would normally respect that trade. And it's going for Lillard and Harden right now. But also, if you didn't get traded, you'd also play if they didn't trade you. I have no idea.
This whole situation is crappy. James Harden had a player option and he decided he wanted to sign it. And then now he's like, oh, wait, I don't want
to. He wants out of it. Yeah.
Yeah. And this is a whole screw over the 76ers organization, screw over Daryl Morey and what he's trying to do there, because he's trying to get the Sixers a championship and put a competent person around Joel Embiid. And he wants to have the 76ers constantly competing. Yet James Harden comes in. He had a pretty good year, stats wise. I know they didn't get to the playoffs how they wanted, but then he comes and he signs his player option, but now he wants out, probably because he was offered a better situation somewhere else, whether that be with the Clippers, whether that be with the Rockets. And now the Sixers have shut down trade talks with everyone, not wanting James Harden to leave. And now James Harden's just basically saying, hey, I'm not going to show up to work. I'm not going to do my job. And it's going to screw over this whole organization. They're going to lose a lot of money. It doesn't matter if he's going to get fined or not, because let's be honest, James Harden is sitting on a mountain of cash. So it's sad to be a Sixers fan in this point in time. They've already been through so much with all the tanking process and all of that. And now you have to deal with diva James Harden stealing all your money.
Yeah, this is a situation where it's hard to like pick a side of the argument to be on, because look at Daryl Morey. I mean, he's built this team. He got Harden there. And Harden just says, no, I don't want to be here anymore. And he's not going to show it to work. And for Harden not to show it to work, it kind of bothers me. And it's not seeing a good example for the youth nowadays, because I know majority of people aren't going to be NBA players or NFL players or anything like that. But if a player, if a person sees James Harden say, "Nah, I'm not getting what I want money wise. Let me just not show up to work." I mean, can you imagine if one of us with our future jobs, we didn't get paid enough, or we didn't think we get paid, got paid enough, and we said, "You know what? Today I'm just not going to show up to work because I don't, I'm not getting paid enough." We would get fired immediately. They don't care. So for Harden to do that, it bothers me. But I also look at Harden's side. Off a couple off seasons ago with PJ Tucker, they signed PJ Tucker to a contract, and Harden decided to take a pay cut so they could do that. And I think Morey did promise him he'd give him a long-term extension. And here we are now, PJ Tucker is on the team, or I think he's gone now, and Harden wants this extension, and Morey didn't give it to him. But he also picked up the player option, but like I'll mention, he didn't have to. So it's a difficult situation to pick a side, because each of these guys has a reason or two that they're right, but also have a reason or two that they're wrong. So I don't know how they're going to handle the situation going forward. Hopefully it's not like the Ben Simmons where they kind of just waited for like the entire season to move him, because Harden is a really talented player and he's getting up there in age and he's probably not going to be around for much longer, but hopefully they get it resolved in the future. All right, moving on to the next story. Doris Burke and Doc Rivers will join Mike Breen on ESPN and ABC's top NBA broadcast crew, replacing Jeff Van Gundy and Mark Jackson, who were laid off by ESPN in July. Breen, Van Gundy, and Jackson had called 15 NBA finals together, guys, and now they're no longer together. What do y'all make of ESPN and ABC basically shaking up the roster here and putting Doris Burke and Doc Rivers on the number one team, a broadcast team?
First of all, about the Van Gundy and Jackson not going to be there with Mike Breen. They did 15 straight NBA finals together. Like, that's going to be different. That's going to be weird watching the NBA finals and not hearing Jeff Van Gundy make a weird remark and Mark Jackson go, "What?" And Mike Breen just keep on going with his bang calls. That's going to be weird. But talking about the two that they replaced him with, first I'll talk about Doris Burke. Doris Burke is one of the only women broadcasters in the sport of men's basketball that really seems like she knows the ins and outs of the game. I mean, Candace Parker is really, really good too, but because she played basketball, and I know Doris played as well, and I believe she played in college, but Doris is very knowledgeable about the game. So she's going to provide that true analyst. And then Doc Rivers is going to be the absolute crazy one. First of all, Doc Rivers does not have a very smooth voice. Like, to have him as the top broadcast crew, I think that needs to be looked at a little bit. But I think getting different perspectives, like a Doris Burke to be with Mike Breen, I like those two together. The Doc Rivers situation, Doc Rivers needs to take on that Kendrick Perkins type of role with that and just be the crazy one, because Doris is going to be very, very analytical and very, very statistical. I think it's going to be good, but it's going to be weird not having Van Gundy and Mark Jackson.
Yeah. I think one Kendrick Perkins is enough, Gray. I think that's enough. That's all we can deal with nowadays.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't like Doris Burke. She's really annoying. She like points out obvious things, and I'm like, I already knew this. I didn't need you to talk about it or say something. Other times, she's a little helpful, but being on the finals call, congratulations to her on joining the crew. But then I go and look at Doc Rivers, and I'm like, Doc Rivers adds a depth to this finals crew. You mentioned how his voice is not the smoothest. It's almost going to be scratchy whenever you hear him talk. It's almost like hearing Bill Walton in your ear. Imagine, I'm not saying that has the intelligence of Bill Walton at this point in time, because let's be honest, Bill Walton is constantly high whenever he's on the ESPN broadcast crew. But Doc Rivers, I know he's going to be close to that same level for me. And I don't really want to watch the NBA finals now. Right. My brain is the only reason to listen to it.
Yeah, I don't like how they split up the trio, because it took 15 years for those guys to be together. And the chemistry they had, I know Van Gundy and Mark Jackson kind of went on tangents a couple of times where they were talking about random stuff on a broadcast. That's what makes it enjoyable, is when they start talking about random stuff and then Mike Breen's over there calling the game and yells bang in the middle of them talking about what they got at the grocery store yesterday. I think that's what made them enjoyable to listen to. And Doris Burke, like you said, Gray, she's talented. She has a lot of stuff that she knows about the game and very intelligent about that. Not a huge fan of Doc Rivers coaching wise. Like I said, his voice isn't the best. Hopefully it's good. I don't think this trio is going to be as good as Van Gundy and Jackson and Breen. I mean, that's probably going to be one of the best ever of all time. And that's sad to see that go. But I'm more excited for the second team of the trio, Ryan Rucco, Richard Jefferson, and J.J. Redick. That's basically the quote-unquote B team on the game telecast. I honestly think if you put Richard Jefferson and J.J. Redick with Mike Breen, that'd be something to watch. Because Richard Jefferson is probably one of my, if not my favorite, analyst on ESPN right now, and J.J. Redick's probably a close second. They're both funny guys, know a lot about the game, and I'm excited for that crew much more than I am the first team. So hopefully this all works out. Do y'all think it's going to work out in the end, or do you think they're going to have to readjust after maybe a season?
I could see them having to readjust because I think I can easily see that. Just like you said, Alex, JJ and RJ becoming part of the A team with Mike Breen, because it's going to be weird that Van Gundy, Mark Jackson, and Mike Breen trio is going to cause some, it's going to be different. Just like I said, just like we all said, that I think that was one of the better basketball broadcasting crews and trios ever. And they showed it through their 15 NBA finals together and however many games. And so it's going to be different, but I do think it's not going to be horrible, but I could see them having to, shake it up a little bit and try out new things until they get something like they had.
No, they need to get the GOAT Richard Jefferson on the call for the finals. I mean, he's probably one of my favorite guys to listen to. He's really funny. And then another guy in JJ Redick, getting him on the team too, is he is very, very knowledgeable about basketball. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I could see like a little playful argument going on between everyone, and just adds a lot of comedy to the broadcast that I think this crew at this current point in time might lack.
Yeah, I think one problem ESPN's having is they'll never have the TNT crew. They'll never have Ernie Johnson, Shaq, Charles Barkley, and Kenny Smith. I don't think anything will ever beat that, ever, for NBA broadcasting in general. I think they're probably the best of all time, for at least me. But hopefully the B team is as good as I think it's going to be. Maybe they'll get Kendrick Perkins in there once in a while to make fun of RJ being bald or something. I don't know. All right, let's move on to the next story. Due to Penn Entertainment partnering with ESPN, Dave Portnoy, the former owner, acquired Barstool for $1, despite previously selling the company to Penn for a reported $551 million. However, Barstool can't advertise any sports books or launch their own. If Portnoy sells the company, Penn gets 50% of the future gross profits. What do y'all make of this, guys? Because Portnoy basically made $551 million and still has this company.
It's crazy. He's unbelievably smart as a businessman. And to get back his company that's shown such huge success. I mean, Barstool blew up. And I think it went way farther than Portnoy has ever thought it would, and he had to get it back from selling it. I think that's good. But the fact that he was able to get it back for a dollar due to like some other clauses that they had when he sold it, I think it's absolutely crazy. And obviously he said he'd never sell Barstool again because Penn would get 50% of the future gross profits. Dude's a genius as a businessman though.
I mean, you have to give him credit. I respect the hustle. I mean, selling your company and then getting it back for $1, dude's on a different level of understanding of business. and he's living the life. I mean, reviewing pizza, doing whatever he wants, just talking his opinion. He is fun to watch whenever he does interviews. He does not hold back, but wow, just getting your company back for $1, that's something new.
Yeah, I thought it was funny on the first day he was back and went to the office. People were showing up late. He got all mad, and it was like a whole TikTok thing where he was roasting all his employees, asking why they got in so late. And there was like a TikTok where he was roasting one of his employees about how they'd written like 12 articles or something in like an entire month, and he pulled him in the office and roasted him and all that. Like you said, Nathan, dude has like no filter when it comes to certain things. That's what makes him enjoyable. Barstool is probably one of my favorite things to pay attention to. Watch their clothes are great. I have a bunch of their stuff. The Jalen Hurts shirt is one of the ones I have and I enjoy. So I think Barstool, Dave Portnoy's done a great job with that, and I don't see him selling it, like you said, anytime sooner, and even before he dies. I mean, dude knows what he's doing, obviously, to make that much money and still have his company. All right. This is a weird one. I bet you Nathan's pretty excited for it. I know he loves his coffee. Dunkin' Donuts is putting out a new line of hard iced coffees and iced teas under the name Dunkin' Spiked. There will be 4 spiked iced coffee flavors, each at 6% alcohol per volume. The flavors being original iced coffee, caramel iced coffee, mocha iced coffee, and vanilla iced coffee. And there will also be 4 spiked iced tea flavors, each at 5% alcohol by volume. And they are slightly sweet iced tea, half and half iced tea, strawberry dragon fruit iced tea, and mango pineapple iced tea. Nathan, I'll throw it to you. You love these food stores to go over. So are you going to go out to the store when this comes out and buy some Dunkin' Spiked?
I'm tired of Alex, man. I'm tired of you putting all of this food crap and drink nonsense on these stories. I'm tired of talking about it. I'm not going to get any of this nonsense. Just money grabbing Dunkin' over here throwing in. Oh yeah. We got some hard iced coffees for you. That is disgusting. They need to be arrested. This is a violation of my human rights.
Great. You can follow it up with.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to go out and buy these because I agree, Nathan, they sound disgusting. But what is with all these companies who aren't in the alcoholic business making these versions of their own product alcoholic? And like Duncan said, it's spiked. Like, what? I don't understand that. I know it's money grab. We've been talking about this whole show, how it's all about the money. It always is, still will be. But, and this is all about the money, but like, ew, why would anybody, that sounds nasty.
Yeah. I mean, I know the, who made the spikes, the lemonade spike things. Who was that?
Simply.
Yeah. Simply spike.
That's disgusting. That's horrible.
Yeah. These companies, like you said, great. Just getting a money grab. Maybe these taste good. I'm not going to be the guinea pig to go taste them all to look for reviews here. I'm not going to be the ding dong that goes out and buys them right off the bat. All right. Last story. This broke as we're recording the show, is former Cowboys running back Ezekiel Elliott signed a 1-year deal to sign with Nathan's favorite team outside of the New Orleans Saints, the New England Patriots. Nathan, you're the biggest Bill O'Brien hater and biggest Mac Jones lover. What are your thoughts on Zeke going to the Patriots?
I mean, he's going to take carries away from Ramondre Stevenson in that offense. It's definitely going to be super run heavy if it wasn't going to be already. Bill O'Brien, I pray that he doesn't waste the talent that Zeke has left, because I think Zeke is still a very viable running back at this point in his career. And it can be him and Ramondre being used as a 1-2 punch in this league. I mean, there's no limit to how good they can do. And then our offensive line holding them back. For Mac Jones, it takes a lot more pressure off him and the receiving crew, knowing that they don't have to pass the ball every single down. So,
great point. I think this is going to be interesting to see how Belichick and Bill O'Brien use Zeke compared to a guy like they use Ramondre Stevenson, and how they do that together. Because just like you said, Nathan, it felt like last year. I mean, always felt like they needed to throw the ball. They were putting Mac Jones in horrible situations. And as good as Mac is, you know, he can't get himself out of horrible situations. And but getting a guy like Zeke who can provide, you know, another threat on the ground, because Zeke is a very good running back. And I know he's probably on the tail end of his career, but he is a very good back. And I think Patriots fans should be excited about this because it adds another weapon to that offense. And not only is it going to provide Ramondre Stevenson, you know, he won't have to be the workhorse back, you know, now that they don't have Damian Harris, but it also, it will provide another weapon for a guy like Mac Jones.
Yeah, you mentioned Damian Harris, Gray. I think Zeke will probably have that similar role of Damian Harris in kind of spelling Ramondre Stevenson. Stevenson will be the go-to back, the 3-down back, and you'll probably see Zeke come in at the goal line in certain situations to kind of play that Damian Harris role, that big body role, and fight through tackles, get extra yards and stuff like that. I think it was a great signing because, like I both mentioned, it kind of takes the pressure off of Mac Jones and that receiving group. I'm just not sure how much Zeke can bring to the table. I know he's not, 29, 30? So, I mean, he's not like he's terrible now. He's not like Adrian Peterson was. But we've seen the NFL, after you hit 29, 30 years old, you're basically at the running back position, you're basically trash. So hopefully he can find something there and the Patriots find his little niche and do well in that, because I think Zeke still has something left in the tank, and I think he brings another dynamic to that offense that really needs it, because last season was not something Patriots fans want to remember. All right, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for listening to Students of the Game.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.